Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is the Brian Lehrer Show podcast. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of our show, but everything we do is available on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
Well, next month, of course, will be the fifth anniversary of the September 11th attacks, and we're devoting some of our programming between now and then to reflections on what we have learned. One of the things that we've learned is about the particular nature of the heroic efforts of rescue workers and others on the front lines that day through various tapes that have come out at various times, and now a new set of tapes has been released to Vanity Fair, revealing for the first time some of the communication within the North American Aerospace Defense Command, otherwise known as NORAD. Maybe you saw the first airing of some of the clips that we're about to play on Nightline this week. Journalist Michael Bronner joins us now to talk us through the tapes and what they tell us about what really happened that day, what we can learn from them regarding preparedness for any such future incidents, God forbid, and why he thinks the Pentagon may even have tried to cover some of this up. Bronner, by the way, helped to write the NORAD scenes in the movie United 93. And for those of you who saw that film, you know that the NORAD scenes were perhaps the most revealing to the audience, because I think most folks had a sense of what they think happened on Flight 93, but very little information about what happened, some of the chaos at NORAD as they were trying to figure out whether that was a hijacked plane and what else was going on in the air after the towers and the Pentagon were hit. So Michael Bronner, welcome to WNYC. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
And I should say, before we get to any of these tapes, that of course, as with anything that's real-life material from 9/11, some of this might be disturbing. So listen if you want to hear them, but be warned that some of you may want to tune out. Before we play some of the tapes, why don't you give us some context? What are these? How did you get them? Why haven't they been out until now?
Well, essentially at the Northeast Air Defense Sector, which is the NORAD unit up in upstate New York, it's New York Air National Guard, but they have a national mission. So it's mostly U.S. troops with a bunch of Canadians as well. They work up there, and all of their radio channels are recorded. They're digital recorders that spin when anyone's plugged in and speaking. So they recorded several channels, and I was ultimately obtained 6.5 hours of real time worth from several different channels for a total of about 30 some hours of actual recordings.
You did some of the writing for United 93, as I said. Was it your research on this that led to your role with the movie, or the other way around?
It was the other way around, actually. I started doing this research and going up to the Northeast Air Defense Sector when I started doing research for the movie United 93. I learned about the tapes and requested them immediately during that research and was played clips of some of them, found them fascinating, asked for more. They said no chance, which was actually good in some way because I spent many, many hours and days with the people that handled those planes, both on the military side and the civilian side. And I don't think I would have been able to make sense of the tapes had I not gotten to know them and what they do so well ahead of time.
Let's listen to a clip, and maybe you could set this up for us. This is the one on the sheet in front of you, titled, This Is Not an Exercise.
Sure. Of the, there are about 37 clips in my Vanity Fair piece. Two or three of them were played at the 9/11 Commission hearing, their 12th hearing, which was in 2004. This first one is one of the ones that was played at the Commission hearing, and basically this is the first word that comes into the military that there's something unusual going on. It's a military or a civilian controller from Boston calling straight to this military unit in upstate New York.
Hi, Boston Center, TMU. We have a problem here. We have a hijacked aircraft headed towards New York, and we need you guys to, we need someone to scramble some F-16s or something up there to help us out.
Is this real world or exercise?
No, this is not an exercise, not a test.
Now, ironically, NORAD was preparing for a training exercise on that very morning, weren't they?
They were. I mean, the military and all elements of the military exercise all the time. And some conspiracy theorists have thought that this was something suspicious. I don't think it's suspicious at all.
I've heard this didn't play
a factor at all in the day.
Conspiracy theorists, some say that it was actually these exercises that resulted in perhaps a mistaken hit of the World Trade Center. And so some people have tried to make that case. But is that why they asked this is not an exercise?
Sure, that's why I asked. There are simulations teams during an exercise that send in simulated scenarios, and he asks simply, is this an exercise, or is this real world? And once he hears that it's real world, the exercise is pretty much dispatched with.
Did it become a source of confusion, though, throughout that day, the fact that exercises were planned for September 11, 2001?
No. You hear troops that have just been recalled come into the floor and ask, you know, what's going on. And once they hear and once they see how serious everybody is, they know immediately that it's not an exercise. And I don't think that it causes any confusion.
Set up this next clip for us, if you would.
Sure. Basically, the techs on the military floor have to get their information from the FAA. Once the hijackers turned off the electronic beacons in the cockpits, that was a vital move, which made it much more difficult for civilian air traffic controllers and the military to track them. The military became completely reliant on the FAA controllers to tell them where these planes are. And there's a section on the military floor called the ID section where there were four women working there, and they just made call after call after call out to the civilian centers to try to get more information. And in this clip, they're trying to figure out where the plane is. The military controllers are looking at a scope that has literally thousands of dots signifying planes, and they're trying to figure out which one is the hijacked plane. It's really a needle in a haystack, and they don't get much to go on in this clip.
Is he inbound to JFK?
We don't know.
You don't know where he is at all?
He's being hijacked. The pilot's having a hard time talking to the... we don't know. We don't know where he's going. He's heading towards Kennedy. He's, like I said, he's like 35 miles north of Kennedy now at 367 knots.
Okay.
No idea where he's going.
If you could please give us a call and let us know, any information, that would be great.
Okay. Now, I guess we're trying to work on... I guess there's been some threats in the cockpit.
There's been what? I'm sorry.
We'll call you right back as soon as we know more info.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, you guys, threats in the cockpit.
You know, they sound very calm, much calmer than they did in the movie.
Well, this is very early on, and it's hard to go back in time and remember that hijacked planes don't crash into buildings, which is their mindset at this point. I mean, their job during a hijack before 9/11 is just to send some fighters up and trail behind the plane at about 5 miles out of sight, just to be on hand if anything goes wrong. And so that's what they're thinking at this point. They're just trying to find the plane.
There was a telling little nervous laugh in the first response in that exchange.
Yeah, the civilian controllers are also baffled. I mean, and at the same time, they're expecting the hijacker to, as one of them told me, fly to Cuba, land, have a cup of coffee, and bang, it's over.
So as you told us before we played the clip, the 9/11 hijackers turned off the transponders. Is there any other way to track an airplane other than that? Do the commercial airlines have any other ways to track their own planes?
Well, the civilian controllers also continued to track them. There's a difference between secondary and primary radar. Secondary is what they get from the transponder, which tells them the name of the plane, the tail number, altitude, and speed. If that's lost, and the controllers are paying attention, which they all were, they can continue to see the raw radar, which is the actual return from the big chunk of metal in the sky, and they can mark it and continue to follow it. But the military then has to rely on them describing where this little dot is, and they never got it together all morning.
So in keeping with the theme of the series, which is what have we learned, something from that experience that has resulted in any technological change or procedural change?
In the military unit's operation floor on 9/11, they were using equipment that was designed in the late 70s. So in the year 2001, they were using 1970s technology. The civilian controllers, it's an incredibly delicate system. It's something that I was amazed at in learning about it. I mean, to think about how many planes are up over the Northeast at any given time, especially at 8:30 in the morning, is unbelievable. And the civilian controllers had state-of-the-art equipment at the time. The military has since obviously upgraded with a several million-dollar upgrade, so now they are online with the same kind of technology as the civilians, but they were really hampered that day.
Boy, you'd think the military would be the first out of the box with technology. That's often the case.
Well, they told me that one of the reasons is that military contracting takes a long time from the time you order to the time it's delivered. That was one reason. But the main reason is that the Cold War was over. This unit is a NORAD unit. Their primary mission was to defend against Russian bear bombers flying over to drop free fall bombs on us. So they weren't really, they were alert, they were ready, but the main mission was not as real as they would have been.
This is 93.9 and AM 820 WNYC and WNYC.org. My guest is journalist Michael Bronner. He has obtained tapes from NORAD of communications during the 9/11 hijackings on September 11, 2001. As he mentioned, a couple of these clips that we're listening to were released to the 9/11 Commission, but most of them have just become available now as published and described in Vanity Fair. They had their first broadcast airing on Nightline earlier this week, and Michael Bronner has been good enough to come by with some of these for us to listen to see what we can learn from these tapes regarding what actually happened on that day and how we can be better prepared in the future. Set up the next clip for us, if you would.
Well, this is the first word that the military gets that something has hit the World Trade Center. Both in the civilian centers and the military centers, you know, it's a far stretch to think that a hijacked plane would fly into a building. Never before had hijackers flown an airplane, and hijackers usually want something rather than hitting a building and destroying themselves. So they hear through news reports, actually, that something's hit the World Trade Center. There are rumors going through the civilian system that it was a small plane. That word goes to the military. It's not until they see the pictures that they realize that it's not a small plane. And the military, I think, even before the civilian side, instinctively starts thinking, does this have something to do with our hijacking?
Is there any...
A plane just hit the World Trade Center?
What?
No, sir.
The 737?
Say what? What's
the World Trade Center?
Who are you talking to? Get pass it to them.
Oh, my God.
311.
Oh, God. Oh, my God.
The shot on the news of the plane just crashed the World Trade Center.
Got update New York.
New York Game of Census ID.
See if they lost altitude on that plane altogether.
New York. Yes, ma'am. Did you just hear the information regarding the World Trade Center?
No.
Being hit by an aircraft?
I'm sorry?
Being hit by an aircraft.
You're kidding.
It's on the world news.
So one thing we learned from that clip is the disbelief with which everybody reacted right away to hearing that news. People who work in this emergency communication military field were shocked that this took place.
Absolutely. And she's calling back to the civilian center, New York Center, just to see if they know about it. And they're equally baffled. I think it's important to remember that there are a lot of controllers in the FAA system. So it's hard to talk generally about the FAA. The FAA did this or that or didn't know this or that. And same holds true with the military. But
we have to take a break in 30 seconds. But didn't American Airlines refuse to confirm that their plane had hit the tower for many hours? And did that change things on the ground for the folks in this bunker?
Well, along those same lines, I can't say for certain that American wasn't talking to someone at the FAA. But certainly the controllers that called to try to confirm weren't able to do that with American at that point in the day, which did cause a lot of problems.
We'll continue with journalist Michael Bronner from Vanity Fair and more of the audio that he's obtained of NORAD on September 11th. We'll hear why their suspicion of a Pentagon cover-up of some aspect of this as a result of these tapes and more. Stay with us on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Don't forget that on Tuesday night next week, We will be doing special election returns coverage in the Lamont Lieberman primary, that that very important race in Connecticut with national implications. I will be hosting beginning at 8 o'clock on Tuesday night on AM 820 WNYC. This will also be live on our website for some of you who can't get AM 820 at night. That's at WNYC.org. And this is going to be on many Connecticut public radio stations as well and Albany public radio. So a lot of interest, of course, in the Lamont Lieberman primary results and analysis of what they mean. Our coverage begins 8 o'clock Tuesday night on AM 820 WNYC. And remember, you can listen live on the web at WNYC.org. We continue now with journalist Michael Bronner from Vanity Fair. He has obtained tapes from NORAD of military communications on the morning of September 11th. We're listening to some of them, talking about what we learned from them, about what really happened that day, what we learned from them about what we might need to do to be prepared for the future. And, Michael, before we play another clip, I've mentioned a few times that your article includes questions about a possible Pentagon cover-up. Of what and why?
Well, when you say a Pentagon cover-up, I'm not sure that that's entirely fair to the Pentagon. What is true and what's obvious from these tapes is that the testimony that the Pentagon gave to the 9/11 Commission the first time it testified, which was in May 2003, is vastly different and was ultimately proved. Several aspects were proved just plain wrong when you compare it to what you hear on the tapes and the timestamp tapes. It's important what time of day things happen. Why they got it so wrong in the first place will be decided by the two investigations that are happening, one at the Defense Department and one at the Department of Transportation. It's important to remember that there are FAA people that are under investigation also. If this was a cover-up, as you said, where did it begin? Did it begin with the administration, with the FAA, with the military, and why? It's hard to imagine why.
Have any speculation, any theories?
Well,
information that confirms or refutes?
Well, we can tell from the tapes that the military didn't have any play really on any of the planes that day at all.
When you say any play?
They didn't know about... The most warning that they had all day was of the first plane, and that was about 8 minutes warning. They didn't get the fighters up until the exact minute that the plane hit the tower, so they really had no chance to get any of these planes. And the main reason was because the FAA gave them information late every time, sometimes really startlingly late, half an hour, 40 minutes, that the FAA knew about a hijack and didn't manage to tell the military for over a half an hour in one case.
Right. At what point did NORAD Major Kevin Nisipany realized that the rules of engagement needed to be changed or come to that conclusion?
Well, on the floor, several of them witnessed the second plane hitting the tower because they got CNN up on the big screen up in front and in the battle cab, the command area in the back. They get a phone call. The phone rings the exact same minute saying, "We have another hijack. It's headed for New York, United 175. They don't know if this is the plane that just hit the building that they just saw. All they know is that this is an attack, and this is way more serious than they thought, and that's what Nisipany is, you know, the urgency in his voice in this next clip, which you're going to play.
I have the tanker. He's on his way back.
Okay, Foxy. Plug in.
It comes up on 360. How long?
Make sure that we're not paying. Okay, Foxy, this is what I foresee that we probably need to do. We need to talk to FAA. We need to tell them if this stuff's going to keep on going, we need to take those fighters and then put them over Manhattan. Okay?
Sir.
That's the best thing. That's the best play right now. So, coordinate with the FAA. Tell them if there's more out there, which we don't know, let's get them over Manhattan. At least we got some kind of play.
All right, you want to talk more about that clip? Was that the one you were referring to?
Yes, so at this point, it's obvious to Nisipany, who's the major who's in charge on the operations floor. He's the one who's orchestrating everything, and he obviously knows immediately that it's an attack. It could be a very big attack. Their mindset right now is that New York is under attack, so he wants his fighters over the city to protect the city. The problem is, and his reference to FAA here, is that there's thousands of airplanes in the air, and the airspace is very, very crowded. And the FAA gives him a little bit of what they call pushback. No one wants a fast-moving fighter colliding with a commercial plane, and that's what they're talking about. That's why he wants them to work with the FAA. He doesn't take control of the fighters at this point. When they're over land, it's the FAA that controls the military planes. He'll take emergency control later in the day, but he doesn't do that yet.
And we can take a few phone calls for journalist Michael Bronner. You've been listening to these excerpts from the September 11, 2001 NORAD tapes that he obtained for Vanity Fair. As we talk about what they mean regarding what happened that day, preparedness for the future, 212-433-WNYC if you want to call in, 212-433-9692 or email brianlehrershow@wnyc.org. After the events of that day, into the 9/11 Commission, officers from NORAD came before the commission, and they were at first not sworn in. And initially, they fudged the events, some people believe. Did they, in fact? And if so, why?
Well, what's clear is that the story they told was very wrong. When you look at the tapes and the timestamp tapes, the 9/11 Commission didn't have these tapes before the first time the military testified. They actually had been told they'd been given everything. They didn't know that these tapes existed in the extent that they did. They didn't find out until they first went up to the unit up in Northeast Air Defense Sector in upstate New York and started interviewing people who handled the planes, and they all referred to their recording channels. All of those people, by the way, the 9/11 Commission said were incredibly open, and as they were with me in telling their story. But the commission said, you know, what are these tapes? We didn't get any of this stuff. They called an end to the meeting. They said, we'll be back. And they went back and filed a subpoena to get these tapes. They had to subpoena the FAA to get their tapes as well. And the FAA gave them trouble in giving this.
Why did they withhold? And why were these NORAD officers not placed under oath to begin with?
They weren't placed under oath because that was the way that the commission were structured. Those were the rules.
Nobody was placed under oath.
No one was placed under oath until 2004 when they changed the rules, realizing that they needed to place people under oath.
Right, because I remember a whole back and forth about whether Condoleezza Rice would be placed under oath. I think it was Rice.
Yes.
So some people were being placed under oath, but at this point in the hearing process, it was not standard practice. And why did they withhold this material?
Well, we'll have to find out. The Major General Arnold, who I talked to at length, said simply that they didn't know the proper information at the time they testified. You know, this is a commission that's mandate is to have a full accounting of what happened on 9/11. This is almost 2 years after the event. For the military to go there without, you know, full knowledge and with such an inaccurate timeline is surprising, and I think that many of the commission members were extremely angry at the time that had been wasted when they realized how wrong it was, which was not for quite a while.
Do you think the deceitful testimony affected the outcome of the 9/11 Commission report, the content or the quality and meaningfulness of it?
No, because the commission eventually subpoenaed the tapes. There were a couple people on the commission who had earphones on for month after month after month. That one was a retired intelligence officer named Miles Kara, who listened to the most. And they knew. They came back at the second hearing with a timeline. They didn't ask questions. They laid out the timeline, which was vastly different from the first timeline the military gave, and said simply, do you accept our timeline? And the same Major General Arnold was back to testify. He maybe took the brunt of this, fairly or unfairly, and he said simply that I do accept this new timeline.
Let's take a phone call. Dylan in Hoboken, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling, Dylan.
Hi, good morning. Love the show.
Thank you.
My question is I haven't read the full transcripts here, but is there anything to suggest that there was military involvement in the flight over Pennsylvania and the downing of that flight?
No, and in fact, there's something to suggest that there's absolutely no way that there was military involvement. You hear on the tapes, which are time-stamped, you hear the first call come in notifying the military that United 93 has been hijacked. That call comes into the military floor at 10:07. The plane has been down for four minutes already. There's a huge information lag that just builds and builds all day, and confusion in the civilian centers as well, because they're trying to land all the planes at this point as well. And a controller in Cleveland called at 7 minutes after 10 and said, yes, we've got another one, American 93, it's been hijacked, it's got a bomb on board. And this sets off a big chase in the military floor, but the truth is the plane had been down already 4 minutes, so there's no way that they shot anything down.
United 93.
Exactly.
Yeah. Dylan, thank you. In fact, let's play the final clip, which I think relates to this. Do you want to set this up for us? It's just 12 seconds, but tell
us what
we're going to hear.
Sure. This is actually earlier in the day, 9:32. And obviously, once they realize there's attack going on, they realize that they're going to try to send planes up to try to intercept these hijacked planes. It's important to note that there are only four armed fighters on the whole East Coast that morning. It's that has to do with reductions after the Cold War. There used to be 60-some armed fighters on alert and ready to go. There are only four for these guys to work with, so they have very limited resources. But this is a Major James Anderson who's standing next to Major Nisipany, who asks the obvious question, if we're able to intercept one of these people, what are we going to do about it?
Have you asked the question what you're going to do if we actually find this guy? Are we going to shoot him down if they got passengers on board? Have they talked about that?
Answer the question.
And what we now know is that they talked about that very seriously, but they didn't make a decision until much later. The decision had to come from the president. The president was obviously being flown to safety. There were difficulty in communications between the vice president and the president. They had a conversation at 18 minutes after 10, which is 15 minutes after we now know the attack was over. And the president gave that authority. That authority was not passed to the military people until 10:31 is when this unit got the order. And at that point, they were more cautious than aggressive because all four planes were down at that point. All the civilian planes were landing. And so you've got thousands of planes off their flight plan. They're having trouble communicating with their fighter pilots in the air, and the last thing they want to do is shoot down a plane by mistake. So they actually don't pass that shoot-down order to the pilots.
Donna in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Donna.
Hi. I was downtown the whole day, and I remember being very upset that I didn't see any fighter planes. You know, we spent so much money here on our defense, and they just weren't there for us. What time did the fire jets actually come? Because I don't remember even hearing one until later in the afternoon.
No, the fighter planes got over Manhattan relatively quickly after the second tower was hit. They were out in a training airspace just off of Long Island holding, and the clip that was played earlier where they clear it with FAA to get them over the city happened relatively quickly, and they were definitely there flying a combat air patrol. I remember seeing them myself zipping over the city. They were intercepting everything that moved at that point. They would dive down and intercept helicopters. You know, one of them flew at 500 feet over Central Park at one point.
Journalist Michael Bronner from Vanity Fair, my guest on WNYC. He obtained tapes from NORAD of actual military communications on the morning of September 11th. This is all written up in the new Vanity Fair. Maybe you saw some of these excerpts on Nightline earlier in the week, and he's been good enough to bring some of them in for us this morning as we talk about what they mean about what happened that day and lessons for future preparedness. And Sonny in East Brunswick, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sonny.
Hi, you guys. How you doing?
Right.
Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I flew for an airline. I was at Newark Airport that day. And you know what? I didn't see the first fighter jet till the first tower had collapsed. And that made me really, really angry that I applaud the FAA for grounding all the airplanes that they did in the amount of time that they did it in, but the military was way behind because they never got word from the FAA what was going on. So I don't blame the military for not being there, you know, before, but, I think there was something on C-SPAN not too long ago where they showed the testimony of whatever investigation that's going on now.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to be on again or not. I missed it, but
well, maybe Michael can fill us in on that a little bit. And you wrote part of the movie United 93, and for people who saw that movie, I mean, one of the most tense bits of drama was the frustration and really the fury of the people at NORAD for not getting authorization to scramble and to shoot down if necessary from their higher ups.
Well, it's not that they wanted to shoot a plane down. They didn't actually intercept one that was hijacked, but they wanted to know very clearly what their rules of engagement were. Shooting down a plane is obviously a huge responsibility, and they wanted very, very clear orders from their higher-ups, and they didn't get those. But in reference to what some of the things that the caller just said, that was one of the things that baffled a lot of the 9/11 Commission staffers that I talked to is, you know, why would the military tell a story that obscures the timeline? Because if you put your thumb over the clock, you know, and look at what they do when they get information, the calls that they make are the right ones, you know, almost exclusively the right ones. And they react very quickly and very seriously. The problem was that they got information late every time from the FAA. And I know that some of the commission members that I spoke to believe that there was an order from the administration to square those two timelines so that the FAA looked a little better. I have no proof of that. That's their belief, and I think that led to their recommendations to the Department of Transportation and Defense for investigations.
You talked earlier about the transponders being turned off by the hijackers, making the planes harder to track by the FAA or by NORAD. So here's an email from a listener who asked simply, why can transponders be turned off anyway?
Well, that's a big question. Why put that switch in the cockpit? And I think that's just an engineering thing that was overlooked. And I know there was a lot of discussion of rectifying that was raised during the 9/11 Commission hearings. And I don't know for sure if that's happened, but I would imagine it has.
Kyle, listening on Sirius in Reading, Pennsylvania. Hi, Kyle. You're on WNYC.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question. I've seen a video called Loose Change. I don't know if the speaker is actually familiar with that.
A little bit. I know generally what it's about.
And?
Well, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, and I truly, you know, try to stay away from things like that, but it brought up some major questions about a few of the incidents on 9/11, in particular the Pentagon and the debris around the Pentagon and the damage that was done to the Pentagon in relation to the plane that was supposed to have hit it. Also, the crash of 93 and the debris field there seems to be some big questions about, you know, lack of debris, things just not making sense.
Any thought about that?
Well, I don't want to get into debunking every single conspiracy theory, but just from these tapes alone, you realize that there are easy answers to some of these if the information is provided. I don't doubt anyone for asking questions. I mean, that's what journalists do also. You know, but for example, the timestamp shows that United 93 couldn't have been shot down. I don't think that the debris field is as it was depicted by the Loose Change people.
We just have about 45 seconds left. This fifth anniversary series that we're doing is called What Have We Learned? What do you think is the biggest lesson that you've learned from being able to review all these tapes and all this material in terms of future preparedness?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, what the biggest message that's in these tapes is how thoroughly these systems, both the civilian air traffic system and the military system, in terms of communicating between each other, how seriously they were disrupted by something relatively low-tech. The systems are very complex. They've made a lot of modifications. So if this same thing happens again, I'm sure that they're much more prepared, but it's the nature of the systems in general that is the biggest concern.
Journalist Michael Bronner, he helped write the movie United 93. He obtained these tapes as a result of his research for that movie. He's now written up the meaning of these tapes and a very interesting article around them in Vanity Fair. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
And in a minute, we'll debrief the heat. Thanks for listening to The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.